about the Global Green New Deal. We'd like to weave together the two bodies of both Naomi's and Astra's work. We want to ruminate a little bit on maybe worst case, best case scenarios, connect some dots around climate justice, climate crisis, energy, migration, housing, living wages, healthcare, war, racial and gender justice, the opportunities and dangers that our current moment holds, and some concerns about some possible pitfalls, what we can learn from history, from models, from structures, from processes, a few little things like that, all from an unabashedly radical perspective. I'm sure many of you know that young people have been at the forefront of declaring a state of emergency. Extinction Rebellion started by shutting down parts of London and really has spread globally. And in this country, back in the fall, activists from the Sunrise Movement which is a relatively new climate change focus group led by young people in universities and high schools, they occupied Nancy Pelosi's office. They demanded for politicians to pledge not to take money from fossil fuel companies, and they called for Democrats to use their majority in Congress to declare a state of emergency about climate change and to introduce a bold response to it, which they're calling the Green New Deal. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, incoming congresswoman from New York, visited them while they were occupying the speaker to be Pelosi's office. And we have this report from the IPCC, that the panel that represents groups of hundreds of climate scientists who are advising governments around the world. And they produced that report that said we had 12 years to reduce fossil fuel consumption by 45%. And now I think that's 11 years. So we, not to start in 11 years, but to have done it in 11 years. So obviously the kinds of solutions that are being posed by the neoliberal, when they talk about, they talk about little things like cap and trade, maybe taxing it, maybe asking people to pay more for gas at the pump. Really what we need is an entirely different framing. What we need is a holistic, far-reaching Green New Deal. Can we start maybe by talking a little bit about how do we make sure that it's the Green New Deal that we want and need in terms of job creation, but jobs with a living wage, in terms of unionized jobs, in terms of responding to climate change in a way that isn't going to cause more people, especially working people, to suffer.
Yammering at each other about this stuff all the time, so the only difference now is we're doing it in public, which is extra fun, I think. We'll see. And I want to thank all of the organizers and all of the volunteers and the amazing team at Haymarket Books for taking such great care of us, for taking political education so seriously. There's not nearly enough of that. It's just so wonderful to see the voracious commitment to ideas, to talking about them face to face, to reading books about them, and to understanding that it's really about applying them and changing the world. So this is, it's really special to be here. So that's a big question, what you said. How do we make sure? And I think, you know, there's so many caveats. I always feel like I need to front load on any discussion about the Green New Deal, starting with the problematic nature of invoking the original New Deal as a touchstone at all, because of who it excluded, because of the hierarchy built in, the fact that so many Black workers were excluded from jobs programs, from relief programs, the fact that Indigenous communities also encountered discrimination under the original New Deal, domestic workers, women were largely excluded. So this is, and then the big picture that the original New Deal emerged as a way to solve a crisis in capitalism, right? The crash of 1929 remains the greatest crisis that capitalism has ever produced. And the original New Deal was a way to rescue capitalism, an attempt to rescue capitalism that didn't fully do it. It was the World War II mobilization, actually, that pulled the U.S. out of recession, out of depression. So here we are confronted with a crisis that is so clearly produced by capitalism, by the extractive world view as applied to the natural world and as applied to workers, to labor, to communities, the idea that we can take and take endlessly as if there is no limit, and then just discard and not think about the impact of this discarding, whether it is the discarding of human life or whether it is the discarding of the planet itself, right? We were promised under trickle-down economics that these blips, as it was presented to us along the way, were just, you know, ugly little stages that capitalism was going through, whether it was the maquiladora factories or the Dickensian factories, right? That these were just sort of growth problems, whether it was slavery, whether it was colonial land theft, that these, we were told that these were just the growing pains of capitalism, and eventually it was going to lift up all the boats and everybody was going to be included. And in fact, it is the precise opposite. That the crimes of capitalism built in from the beginning never went away, and the sacrifice zone has just grown bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, now to engulf the entire planet, the habitability of the planet. So that's where we are. So we just saving capitalism, saving the American way of life, as it is sometimes called, is not an option, because that is what is producing the crisis. I happen to believe that it is still useful to invoke a time when change happened quickly. Not because it is not problematic and we need to constantly qualify, but because in my experience, the biggest barrier that we are up against as we talk about the things that must happen in the face of that ticking climate clock is a very widespread feeling that we are already doomed, and that we are doomed because we are incapable of the kind of change that is required. And people believe this because they have been told this again and again and again. And we now have several generations who have no living memory of a collective project, and they have no experience of a state that wasn't in the context of unmaking those parts of the state that actually did benefit people, right? So to me, the benefit of invoking the New Deal, as problematic as it is that it addresses that sense of helplessness head on, and it, you know, gently awakens a collective memory of a time when people organized on a massive scale and the parts of the New Deal that were genuinely progressive were progressive because of massive organizing and collective action. The sit-down strikes in Flint, the port strikes on the West Coast that shut down the entire West Coast ports, general strikes that shut down entire cities, the fact that you had a socialist candidate in California almost winning, all of that put so much pressure on FDR to do more and to increase. So this is why I think it is useful. And the other reason why it's useful is that it is, as you said now, a holistic frame that is about changing the whole economy. Because the way we've tended to talk about climate change has been this idea that there can just be a climate policy, like cap and trade, or a carbon tax. And that will just solve this for us. And we can just add it to a list of other things that we're doing. The benefit, I think, of invoking a New Deal-style mobilization is that we are necessarily then talking about a transformation of the economy. And then we need to battle for what that transformation looks like. Like, that puts us on much more solid ground. But you'll notice that in this framing, we added the word global. And we did that deliberately because I think Astrid and I both agree that the discussions around the Green New Deal in this country, in the UK, although it's getting a little better in the UK because of pushback, is still far too nationalist and indeed too imperialist in that there's too much of a framing around, well, our manufacturing sector is going to win the race for new technologies or we'll sell them to the whole world. And it isn't reckoning with the huge issue of ecological debt, which is another reason why I wanted to have this conversation with Astra, is at the core of the climate crisis is this massive debt that is owed from the world's greatest consumers, who are overwhelmingly in wealthy countries, but it's not everybody in wealthy countries. It's the top 10% of the wealthiest people on this planet who are responsible for about 50% of the emissions. The top 20% are responsible for more than 70%, okay? And yet, the people who are most impacted by climate change, who are already having their lives massively disrupted, who are already being forced to migrate, whether internally within their countries or across borders, are, without exception almost, the people who did the least to produce the crisis. So there is a debt that is owed, and the way that we respond to climate change is a massive opening to talk about redistribution of wealth and reparation.
Amazing to be here. I totally love everything Naomi just said and have learned so much from you. It's also so great to be here at a conference where everyone calls one another a comrade. And I think we can see a little bit of a hopeful future just in the sense that there's all these socialists in this weird mall. Makes a good future easier to picture, actually, to imagine. So let's build on that. I think when you just say climate emergency, the word emergence really struck me, right? In that we have to use this emergency to create another world. And just to underscore, I came across some statistics on strikes, the strikes that happened around the Great Depression. And these are both overwhelming numbers, but actually kind of hopeful. So in the late 20s, there were 500 strikes, and that number went up to 3,500 by 1937. Right? And so that's the other kind of fast-paced change that is possible and that we need to see, because that, I think when we talk about a New Deal, it feels like it's something given by the government. Right? It feels like a top-down, anti-democratic sort of solution, but it was something that was only possible, as you said, through intense mobilization. So 3,500, I think there were 20 work stoppages in 2018. We can totally make that, we can get there. On the debt front, so it's Das and I co-founded something called the Debt Collective. And the idea is that we live in a world where finance is extractive. So we're talking about the fossil fuel industry is extractive, but finance is also extractive. It extracts from people, it extracts our time. And we talk about the financialization of the economy. That means that more and more money is extracted from us by the financial sector, and that credit and debt are essential. And so when you have credit and debt, you're stuck into these interest rates, right, that are driving growth. You're borrowing money, and maybe there will be more to pay for it later on. So we're stuck in this math that defies physics, right? Economic logic and the logic of ecology are at odds. And you know, so what we try to do strategically is to say, okay, you have you are in debt for your education, you're in debt for healthcare because you're not able to access those services, because there isn't universal healthcare, because there isn't free higher education. And what happens is we're stuck paying these odious debts for things we deserve as human beings, and we're defaulting on our true social debts. And so one thing we have to do is figure out, when can we say, like, hell no, we won't pay you. We don't owe you for the right to not be sick or to learn, but we do need to pay reparations. We need to pay our climate debt. And I think, you know, some academics of talent that can pay, the last I saw was the US owes someone like $4 trillion. You know, they tried to put a number on it. Certainly that number is growing exponentially, but I think there's just something, I think there is a sort of philosophical and moral framework to thinking in terms of debt and who is with whom, but there's also the strategies that can come from that. So we were just talking to Naomi's friends from Puerto Rico, and we know that there's a sovereign, yes?
Yes. I'm gonna ask you two to stand up, actually.
Yeah.
Joaquín from Punta Gente. Professors from the University of Puerto Rico who stood with the students when they went on a 3-month strike. They organized their faculty, and then after Hurricane Maria hit, and I was there reporting for the Battle of Paradise, they were my hosts there and showed me around, and then also convened this amazing meeting of organizers from the trade union movement, farmers from the agroecology movement, students, teachers, and people who are fighting the legitimacy, or indeed the odious nature of Puerto Rico's debt. And they have formed this coalition, which really is a proto-Green New Deal, because they've been having assemblies all across the archipelago to consult people on what a truly just recovery for Puerto Rico would look like. So we're really honored that they're here, I'm gonna let Astrid continue, but I do wanna remind folks that every cent from Battle for Paradise goes to their organization. So even if you already have a copy, you should buy more because they're there. And all the money goes to Puerto Rico so that they can tell us how to actually do the Green New Deal right.
But that, you know, that's just an example of how this incredible debt is used not just to prevent climate resilience, but also to attack education, to impose austerity on people. And you know, this is something that we see across the world, but also in our cities, right? And these are structures of power that we should look at and try to find forms of leverage. Actual places where we can say, okay, this is an illegitimate form of wealth extraction, and we want that money to go to things that actually enrich all of us and not just the 1%, not just the financiers. So I think there are some interesting strategic levers that we can find as we look for ways to tackle the climate crisis from new angles. The last thing I want to say is that, you know, I'm looking for these because I'm not someone who just exists in the climate justice space. So I felt like a bit of an interloper being on this panel. But I think the challenge, we are all climate activists, right? We have to be. And I think that doesn't mean necessarily that we only focus on CO2. or what is considered the traditional environmental movement. If you're working on issues of public goods, if you're working on issues of immigration and racial justice, indigenous sovereignty, health, if you're in a teacher's union, if you're in a nurse's union, we can all find ways to connect to the climate struggle. So I know my organizing, this sort of feels like a thing, how do we all make that as authentically part of our organizing as it actually is, right? And that doesn't, I think that it doesn't mean necessarily that we have to become climate justice activists in a silo, but to connect climate to whatever work we're doing. And that's a challenge I'm sure lots of us are trying to think through and imagine new paths forward, so I'm gonna do it.
I just wanna add, a little bit because you asked specifically about workers. An example of what Astra's talking about around a great example of a radical trade union that really went deep on what a just transition would mean to their sector. Right? Dad mentioned that I've been involved in this group called The Leap, which is a people's platform that was developed with about 60 social movements to come up with a plan for how to get to 100% renewable economy that had justice and indigenous rights, racial justice, gender justice at the center of it. And it's a kind of manifesto. And it's broad strokes, and these things, they always start broad strokes, but then they need to get specific, and they need to get rooted in individual sectors, in individual workplaces, in individual movements, right? And that's where it becomes real. And I think to the great credit of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ed Markey and the way they drafted the resolution, the Green New Deal resolution, it calls for the specifics to be worked out democratically at the community level with the frontline movements leading. And yet, I think there's still this sense, and people approach me all the time, like, you know, well, so what's next? You know, and like, who's doing it? And as if there's some central committee that is just going to give everybody their marching orders. But we already have our marching orders, right? The marching orders are organizing your communities and democratically do what Puntamente is doing, have the assemblies, and come back and say, this is what we demand, right? And so in Canada, where we developed the LEAP, the Postal Workers Union, CUPW, which is one of our more radical unions, found themselves in a pitched battle with the federal government that wanted to privatize the post office, eliminate mail delivery so that everybody would have to go to post offices, and basically sell the remaining physical infrastructure to FedEx. And rather than just accepting the terms of the debate and just trying to get a little bit of a better deal, what CUPW did instead is they worked with our team from The Leap and came up with a plan that they call Delivering Community Power, which is a vision for the post office for the future, the post office of the future, which says, okay, well, we recognize that the way people are getting their mail is different now, right? But we also recognize that we have incredible public infrastructure in every community. I mean, there are more post offices in Canada than there are Tim Hortons donut shops, and the Canadians in the room, I know, you know there are a lot of Tim Hortons in Canada. And so they said, why would we sell this off when we could transform it? And so they put forward this vision of post offices with charging stations out front, solar panels on the roof, postal banking that is lending to community-controlled renewable energy, a made-in-Canada fully electric fleet of vehicles, which is delivering the mail, but not just the mail, also locally grown agriculture, and checking in on the elderly, doing care work. And this is what we need. We need teachers unions doing this. We need nurses unions doing this. We need manufacturing unions doing this. What does it mean in your workplace? What does it mean in our movement? What is the truly transformative vision? And we shouldn't want anyone to hand that to us, right? It would be a disaster if they did. But I think like some core principles are under your question of how do we make sure that workers don't get a raw deal, as they so often do, like under the McCall climate plan, right? A truly neoliberal plan where you slash taxes for the ultra rich and you ask working people to accept increased gas prices at the pump. And then you're surprised when there is, you know, a huge revolt. So that doesn't work. It doesn't work in order to lower emissions, and it especially doesn't work because people will revolt and you'll have to roll it back, which is what Macron did. So it's always packaged as pragmatic, but there's nothing pragmatic about it because it will not get the job done and it will generate a massive backlash, right? So what we need is a vision for dealing with climate change that's going to get huge buy-in because people understand that it will make their lives better, right? And so a few ways that we do that is we recognize that there are huge parts of the economy that are engaged in low carbon work and it isn't recognized as being a green job, right? And this is why we call this care and repair, because actually caring for the sick is low carbon work. And teaching kids is low carbon work. And so making art is low carbon work. And so much of the labor that actually enriches people's lives build stronger communities that are more resilient in the face of shocks and disasters is actually low carbon and can be made even more so if each of these sectors does the kind of deep organizing that needs to happen and you know comes up with plans saying, okay, we need our community health centers near public transit, which doesn't happen nearly enough so that it's accessible and so on, right? Care work is climate work. It isn't just a guy in a hard hat putting up a solar panel, though it is that too. But we have to be expansive about it because there are parts of our economy that need to contract, but there are also parts of our economy that can expand. But we also need a plan for workers whose sectors need to contract, right? Whose sectors need to be phased out gradually in a deliberate way. And those workers need to be retrained, obviously, but the retraining process needs to be democratic. I mean, you talk to trade unionists in so many of these sectors, you use a word like transition, what they say is that's the word we hear before we're about to get fired. They don't trust that word at all, right? And the only thing that's going to build trust is genuine democratic design in the transition. So we've got a lot of work to be done, but we also need to call out trade union leaders who are essentially, you know, a cover for the fossil fuel industry. And we've seen a lot of that.
So, I mean, because of our abysmally low rates of union membership, right, and this small sector of the organized workforce can claim to speak for all workers, right, and so that I think is something that is also problematic. And those of us who aren't in unions and do other kinds of work need to speak also as workers who want a different kind of employment and different kinds of work. I saw today on Twitter somebody said, you know, there's David Gerber's idea of bullshit jobs, but it was also that there are batshit jobs, and no one should have a job that's killing the planet. You know, down with batshit jobs. But I love what you said because it also cuts off at the past two things the right uses. So one, the right saying, you know, creating this antagonism between environmentalists and workers, right? Even as they got protections and make people live precariously. So it, I think it's great for the left to get out in front of that and say no. We're creating jobs, but also it speaks to people's fear. And Haven Coleman, who's one of the Climate Strike founders, where is she? Yeah. You said very. You were talking about how people want change, and then they're afraid, right? And sometimes that fear is understandable. It's not, you know, that they want to continue business as usual. And so I thought that was, you know, speaking to people's fear in an understanding way instead of using fear to cause people to tune out or just hold on to what they know. But that was something that I really took from your speech. That was great.
I feel like you're making my job really hard because you keep answering the questions before I get to ask them. but one of the things that the conversation is making me think about a lot is that in what's being proposed so far, you know, in terms of like what we need to, how we need to frame this Green New Deal, there's a lot of talk about it being super, I think you used the word bonanza when we were talking about it before, more jobs, we all want, you know, a better life, more free time, but does that also mean always more investment? And you know, when do we confront the logic of endless growth? I mean, you touched on it a little bit before, but I think it's worth unpacking because It's like, how do we lower the emissions and not have this vision of endless growth and endless extractability?
So it's really hard. And this is the thing that worries me most about the ways in which the Green New Deal is being discussed so far, is that it is still this idea where we're putting off the hard discussions. Okay, let's be honest about that. Where it's still this kind of idea that everything, like Arundhati Roy says, she talks about the urban environmentalists who ask the question, how do we change without changing? So the idea is, how do we lead the exact same lives, but just substitute renewable energy for fossil fuels, right? And we say, well, we have the technology, we can do it, you know, we can do a ton with renewables and battery storage. But the truth is that what we need to do now, because we have procrastinated for so long, right? So if we're gonna listen to what the IPCC, a report that Gal mentioned, said, which is that anything above a warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius is catastrophic, and the difference between 1.5 degree warming and 2 degrees warming is, you know, hundreds of millions of lives. If we want to take that seriously, then wealthy countries need to be cutting our emissions by about 15% a year, okay? There is no economist on this planet who can tell you how you cut emissions by 15% and still have economic growth as it is currently construed. They will talk a good game about decoupling, about dematerializing the economy, and there are things that we can do, right? With a more sort of virtual economy, decoupling is real, and it can get you to about 3% emission reduction. It can't even get you near 15% emission reduction. So we are talking about a different kind of economic system. Capitalism cannot do this. Now, I've been presented as saying, well, you know, unless we have a capitalist revolution tomorrow, nothing is worth doing. And I don't believe that, but I think that the things that we do need to get us on that road to transformation. And there's a lot that we can start doing now, but we have to be honest about the fact that it is fully possible to launch a Green New Deal, create millions of green jobs, in renewables, efficiency, public transit, rapid rail, have a jobs guarantee, make sure people are paid a living wage, and we could end up with a Green New Deal carbon bubble, the likes of which we've never seen, because people will spend their increased salaries at Walmart and other places, and we'll have this sort of idea of energy cornucopia, as long as it's green. The other thing is that when you do the kind of infrastructure rollout that we're talking about, you're gonna burn a lot of fossil fuels, because we currently have an economy that is built on fossil fuels. So if we do those things quickly, which we must do, we are gonna burn a lot of carbon. So we need a plan for how to contract the things that we can contract. Now, I think we need to figure this all out now. What I think we need to do is just be honest, that we need to be kept honest. So what I would like is to see, it's for whoever is putting forward a Green New Deal to agree that it needs to have a built-in carbon audit. So that we have a panel of serious scientific experts who tell us whether or not our emissions are going up or down, and whether we are within our carbon budget to keep to that 1.5 degree target that is what we have agreed to. So I don't think we need to figure this all out now, and I don't think we need to all agree that capitalism can't do this. You know, what I think we need to do is agree to audit ourselves. And if we audit ourselves, we will find that we need another economic system. Because it's just not possible, the math doesn't add up. So that's my way of kind of kicking the can down the road, but not kicking it down. what do you think, Astrid?
I mean, I have these fears because I've been pushing for a student debt jubilee, which now, you know, the economists have said it would create a stimulus of $100 billion a year for at least a decade. And Ilhan Omar has, you know, wonderfully advanced this idea in Congress and has a student debt cancellation act. And then this other part of me is like, okay, we've been fighting for this, but will it just cause people to consume more stuff? So I think there is something that there is worrisome. On the growth front, I guess my only thing I want to say about capitalism is that, you know, part of the problem is that this question, we want things to grow and we want some things to shrink. And under the system we have, the solutions, because they're not profitable, are just not invested in, right? So it's also trying to open up new avenues where our collective wealth, our resources, can be put into the things that we need, right? There are so many things that are off the table that would be wonderful to see because they're not profitable in the system. And so that's part of the paradigm shift that we're looking for, is how do you actually make investments in a way that is actually rational, which is what capitalism always says it is.
And that's how I think we build decommodification into this. So, I mean, a great example of what Astra's talking about is, it turns out that if you want people to use public transit, one of the great ways to do it is to make it free. You know, there are some European cities that have done this. France, whenever Paris hits a certain level of particulate pollution in the air and it becomes dangerous, the way they take cars off the roads is they make the metro free. And lo and behold, the air clears. People take the metro and it's free. But it needs, you know, we need massive investments to be able to handle that increased capacity because all of our public transit is stretched to capacity. But that's a kind of a decommodified solution that people immediately like, right? It helps working class people the most. And it gets us on the right road, right? So without having to have every single ideological battle won before we start. But we need to choose our battles. That's, you know, free public transit is a better battle to choose than a carbon tax.
I was wondering if we could turn our attention a little bit to the crisis that's, you know, ongoing at the southern border, and maybe talk about it in terms of, like you were saying before, Astra, how do we connect the dots? You know, people who are outraged, you know, as rightly about the caging of children. How do we talk about this and bring some of those struggles, you know, together?
Loudly. I mean, we all know that we can't separate the climate crisis from the crisis at the border. We can't separate the climate crisis from militarism. I did just read the new UN report, which talks about climate apartheid, right, and uses that phrase, that in 2017, 18.8 million people were displaced in 135 countries, right, and this is twice the number displaced by conflict. And of course, you can't really separate this. But I guess, you know, the one thing I'll say, and hand it to Naomi, is that there's been rightfully attention to the call for open borders, which I think is really important, and freedom of movement. And the idea that no one is illegal. But I think we need to couple the call for freedom of movement with freedom to stay. Right? Yeah. People should be able to live in their homelands and not have the seas rise and destroy their communities. People should be able to live in the land they love and be connected to it. And this is something, people are being displaced by war, they're being displaced by poverty, they're being forced to move. They're not coming to America because we're so great. You know, that is not why people leave their homes and leave the places that they know and love. And so I think the right to stay is central, and it connects to the history, the roots of capitalism. Capitalism came about through the enclosure movement, through kicking people off the land, disconnecting them, making them migratory, because that makes people more vulnerable. And so I think that we need to fight for struggles. This is where struggles for indigenous sovereignty, for people being able to have a relationship to the land, for people being able to have economic opportunity where they live. So this is part of the internationalism of the Green New Deal. Right to move, right to stay.
I mean, the only thing I guess I'd add to that is, I don't think it is a coincidence that white supremacy is surging in so many settler colonial nations at the very moment that the climate crisis is no longer really possible to deny, even if you pretend.
No.
Even if you pretend you deny it. I don't believe that climate change deniers actually believe they're a bullshit. And I've hung out with them. I've gone to the Heartland conferences and so on. What they truly believe is that they'll be all right, right? What they truly believe is that their wealth will insulate them. And, you know, this is a country built on what Cedric Robinson called racial capitalism, where the ideologies of ranking human life were necessary to rationalize the barbarism of slavery and colonial land theft. That is why those ideas emerged at the time that they emerged. We know this. I don't believe it's a coincidence that they are now surging at a moment when there are more people on the move in the world than there have been at any point since the Second World War. Those ideas are necessary in order to rationalize the barbarism on the border. In this country and in Europe, where thousands of migrants are being left to drown with no witnesses in the Mediterranean, where aid is being criminalized as it is here, the same thing has been happening in Australia for a long time, where they have had concentration camps on Manus and Nauru. And so there is a deep understanding that there will be more people who are going to move, that the impact of all of this theft is coming home. And there's kind of this puts us at a crossroads. And what do we do in a moment like this? What kind of people are we going to be? Are we going to share what's left of this habitable earth, or are we going to hoard? And are we going to protect our own and put up those fortresses against everybody else? And if we are going to do that, then we need theories that rationalize that, right? It's interesting in a horrible way that the Christchurch killer, the Christchurch terrorist who killed more than 50 people in two mosques on the same day as the youth climate strikes. He called himself an eco-fascist. It was in his manifesto. And I think we're going to see more and more of this sort of tipping from denial into outright eco-fascism, into we are not denying it, but we are okay with people drowning because they are lesser. So I just think we need a much more coherent analysis of the moment we're in. I call it climate barbarism. And we need a much stronger and coherent connection with where militarism and war fits in. I mean, why is it that our two hotspots, Venezuela and Iran, happen to have a whole heck of a lot of oil? Is that just another coincidence, right? Between our thirst for oil and the wars that continue to roil and destabilize our world is undeniable, right? And now we have drought in so many of those parts of the world that acts as a further accelerant and pushes more people to migrate. So we need actually a much broader, one of the critiques of the Green New Deal in the punditocracy in this country is it's too broad, it's everything at the kitchen sink. My critique is that it's actually not broad enough. We need stronger, as Astra said, We need much stronger language on the connection with militarism. There's no way to solve climate change by greening the military. We have it in this country. Hurricane Katrina was climate apartheid. That was not the future. That was the past. And we saw exactly what it looked like, right? We saw the intersection of extreme weather hitting a weak and neglected public sphere starved by neoliberal austerity and overlaying it all white supremacy that blamed the victims who were left behind on rooftops asking for help, and they were abandoned, right? And they were blamed and called looters and everything else. But if you had a car and you had insurance, you were able to drive out of the city, right? Check into a hotel, call your insurance company. That's climate apartheid. It is not the future. It's actually the past and the present. Puerto Rico is climate apartheid. It is happening right now. After everything that has been inflicted on that island, they want more. They're cutting pensions, they're cutting food stamps. It is because of that same hierarchy of humanity. So it's, you know, I think we have to get out of the habit of talking about this as a future thing. As William Gibson said, the future's here, it's just unevenly distributed, right? Another piece of this, though, is I think recognizing and valorizing migrant labor as climate labor, as green work, as climate work. You know, I remember being in New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, and every single person who was cleaning debris off of people's houses and branches, every single person was a migrant worker. And after they finished rebuilding and putting roofs back on homes, many of them were deported immediately after. Same thing happened in Houston. It happens again and again and again. So it is the right to move, it is the right to stay, and it is full rights for migrant workers in this country who are doing the work.
So this is gonna maybe seem like a jerky thing to say, but let's say that, you know, I think we all talk to various people who are in various places of being convinced whether or not we need to do something, whether how quickly we need to do it. I guess one thing I want to put to you all just to unpack a little bit more is, what do you say to someone who says, well, I agree with everything you're saying about what we need and how we want to try to make sure that it gets into something like a Green New Deal, but as it is right now, it's not radical enough. I can't support it. I'm actually feeling like, oh, I'm gonna, you know, walk away from this. Do I really have that choice?
I'm gonna
guess that you're gonna try to convince me not to.
What do you think? That's what I think.
I mean, I think the thing is, we're talking about the Green New Deal. It's not even a thing yet, right? It's the proposal of a hypothetical thing. And I think, given where the conversation has been at, it is a breakthrough. You know, there is a kind of classic left division, right, between reform versus revolution, but I think there's more of a dialectic, right? Like, you know, something happens, and it's an opportunity to mobilize around it. Kate Aronoff on her panel made this point really well, right? That these are moments, something's proposed, brings people in, we try to make it more real, more substantive. And so I guess I would throw the challenge back on someone, which is, if it's not radical enough, then what do you do to radicalize it, right? If this is something, or whether your focus is on the Green New Deal or on something in your community or something in your circle, you know, the onus is on all of us to get it where we want to be.
Okay. Yeah, I think I'd say, like, what part of 11 years left don't you understand? You know, I often, when I'm being interviewed by skeptical journalists, which I've spent too much of my life doing, you know, there's so many journalists see themselves as sort of guardians of the safe center, right? And not getting too excited about anything. And they're always sort of playing, you know, the devil's advocate, and it's too much. But you know, what I always say to them is like, you know, there isn't actually an extra planet for just for journalists out there. You know, like you're stuck on the same level as us. And Elon Musk isn't taking you on his rocket ship. He can't afford it. So I would say, you know, there also isn't an extra planet for radical Marxists out there. So if it's not radical enough for you, to make it more radical. And you know, we have, this is a lifeline. You know, I sometimes feel, I ask myself these questions because when I go back and look at This Changes Everything, which some people describe as a hopeful book, when it came out in 2014, the truth is it's a less hopeful book when you read it in 2019, because the whole framing of it was that we are in decade zero, right? And that ends next year, right? So I ask myself, well, how long am I going to keep coming out here and just being like, all right, we still can do this, guys. We've got years left. And will I still do it when I'm just like, we've got 2 years left. We can cut emissions by 75%. We start right now. It's not, you know, I don't know when that no longer becomes credible. But I do know that we don't have, any of us have the luxury of just sitting back and critiquing. We are in this together. It doesn't mean we don't hold each other check and call each other out when we need to be called out, but the idea that any of us can walk away from this, it's just not true. I mean, we talk sometimes about building, you know, big tent. The atmosphere is our big tent. You know, we are in this big tent together, whether we notice it or not. So I hope very much that those of us who are more comfortable in that critique role as opposed to the, okay, now it's time to build it, that we can all get out of our comfort zones a little bit and make this as strong and as radical as it needs to be, that we show each other some patience and forgiveness as we build and keep our eye on the prize. Because you need, as Nina Turner says, everything that we love is on the line. That's it. Everything that we love is on the line. And we need to build a multi-racial, multi-ethnic, multi-generational, multi-faith movement to do this together. It really does take everyone. So, yeah, that's what I would say.
Our session is actually coming to a close because we are limited on time, and I just wanted to let people know that both of you will be available to get books signed. There's a whole stack up here, most people can't see them, but that's going to happen right after this session, and you know, we're going to be lining up on that sky bridge right outside of the book room. So I recommend that people get your books first and then line up, and we'll make sure to have both ask
questions.
Yes, absolutely. I was going to give you that. One thing I did, if you can maybe try to respond to this, but don't feel like you need to, one of the questions, you know, I remember the days of the climate justice movement, and, you know, it's something, was it 20 years ago at this point? Right?
DJ, yeah.
Yeah. And there was a sense of possibility and of hope, and that we could change the world, that, you know, Teamsters and Turtles together. And that kind of crashed with, you know, the World Trade Center towers. And I wonder if we can talk a little bit about how do we build in resiliency in our movement so that, you know, we can continue, and it isn't going to be going back to step one around those.
Yeah, God, it is 20 years in November of the Battle of Seattle, Teamsters and Turtles. And I mean, it to me, it makes me a little bit sad when I think about that, when I think about where we were 20 years ago and the kind of coalitions that we had between environmentalists and trade unionists, actually further along than we are now. And the truth is, we were right. We were righter than we knew. Because though climate change was a part of the analysis in the critique of the World Trade Organization and of corporate globalization, but it was sort of a footnote, right? And, you know, when I wrote No Logo, I didn't understand that this global web of manufacturing that I was tracking, which was so abusing workers' bodies and health, was also warming the planet so catastrophically. But now the data is in, and we know that these past 20 years have carried with them this massive emission spike precisely because of that economic model that was globalized through institutions like the World Trade Organization. And after Seattle and then Genoa came 9/11. And in the global north, the movement fractured. And in particular, the trade union movement didn't want to be seen to be associated with anarchists and property destruction. It seemed too close to terrorism, and the coalitions broke apart, never came back together. In the global south, that wasn't true. The coalition stayed together, and some of those movements became governments. But it's a reminder that if we understand how little time we have left, that we do have to understand that we live in a time when shocks are not the exception. There will be shocks. There will be more natural disasters. There will be economic shocks. There will be other kinds of shocks. And we've seen again and again how movements can be derailed in those moments, particularly in national security panic. And so I think it's really important for us to build resiliency into how we organize for us so that we can't be taken by surprise. And I think it's another reason why it is so important to have an analysis that is truly holistic about the centrality of war and the way our wars fuel backlash and violence and terrorist attacks. The more truth we tell, the harder it becomes to change the subject, because the subject will be part of the story that we're already telling, right? But if we have tunnel vision, and if we tell ourselves, oh, well, that's not as popular as this, and we think this is more marketable than that, then we will be blindsided, because that is what has happened to our movements again and again. So if we needed another argument for telling the truth, I think that's a good one.